So I'm putting on the recorder. We're here at Matan. We are here in the month of Sivan, getting ready for Matan Torah. Now we are studying Judaism and the isms, and we are up to, just based on the discussion, the debate, and the fire that we had last session, this is an important topic that many of us feel passionate about, and it's about Judaism and its encounter with feminism. So there, I mean, this is a massive topic. I have to be honest. I have been still figuring out how I want to organize this, and there's no perfect way to do it. But last week we focused on what I called feminism in the Tanakh, for examples of women's leadership, of women breaking gender, basic gender assumptions, women doing things, let's say, that are out of the box or unexpected, and, you know, trying to assess how is this perceived, positively, negatively. And the truth is that we found very interestingly that women's leadership, women playing a significant role in leadership, national or communal, is celebrated in many ways in Tanakh. And there are many great women heroines in Tanakh. Now, this doesn't mean we recognize this is not the same thing as modern feminism, which is calling for equality in terms of pay and equality in terms of roles and equality in terms of identity and holding office and voting. That's a whole other thing. And we're going to get to a little bit of that more today. I don't think it would be fair to say that in Tanakh that women are viewed, you know, negatively. I don't think that's the case. But they don't have the same role as men, that's for sure. And men are much more dominant in Tanakh. That's also, that's incontrovertible, just from studying Tanakh and going through the stories and seeing which characters play primary roles. But women are not, they're important. How shall I say it? I do not mean this in a negative sense, but they're, you know, critical supporting actors, you know, in many different stories of Tanakh, and pivotal role players in many of the stories that we looked at and that we studied. So that was in terms of Tanakh. What I want to do today is I want to fast forward to modern times, to the 20th century, and I want to look at two different models of and attempts and opportunities to explain the status of women in halakha and the status of women in Jewish law. And these two different examples will cross paths at a particular point. They are both coming from the modern Orthodox community, so they have a particular lens, which, you know, we agree with, but it's a particular lens. But we're going to look at these two different models and compare them and contrast them in today's shiur. So first of all, does everybody have the source sheet that I gave you last week? Does everyone still have last week's source sheet, or at least a link to it or access to it? If you do not, sort of raise your hand and I will send you the link. Okay, Sylvia. Hello, Sylvia. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to send this right now. Okay, I'm just going to send this file. Let's see. Give me 1 second.
It could also be downloaded as the source sheet accessory to the YU Torah posting.
Oh, so you know what? You want to just put in the link there so that people could see it, if you don't mind, Don? Okay, but I'll send it anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna send. It's gonna send another version. One second. Okay. Could you give me 1 second? I just gotta get this here. You know what? I'm struggling to do this. I'm going to send it on WhatsApp. That may be the best way to do it. Matan. I'm going to send an attachment to the document. if I'm going to be able to find it. If not, you know what, I'm going to share it on the screen. Okay. So I'm going to share it on the screen when we, okay. So yeah. what we're looking at now is we're going to look at two different thinkers. We're going to look at a thinker by the name of Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who just passed away actually a few weeks ago. And I'm going to talk about him in just a second. And we're also going to listen to, we're going to look at a conversation between somebody by the name of Joel Roth, who was a very prominent conservative rabbi in America, and an interlocutor of his by the name of Rabbi Gideon Rothstein, who was actually a former chavrut of mine. He's a big Talmid Chacham. He's someone I learned with in the past, and that I, I'm in dialogue with at different points in time. Now, let me give you some context for these two different pieces. So, in about, I think maybe it was 1975 in America. Now, a lot of the discussion around feminism and Judaism, well, it sort of starts in America because America is a place of freedom. America is a place of equal rights. America is a place I don't want to say it's a place of enlightenment, at least at this point right now, but it, in the past, it was a place of these things, and everyone gets a vote, right? No taxation without representation. America is the strongest democracy, or has been the strongest democracy in the world. And therefore, it's specifically within the Orthodox community in America, the modern Orthodox community in America, that discussions around feminism have been more significant. They've also taken place in Israel, but less so. And even more interestingly, many of the people who are bringing modern orthodoxy and certain feminist ideas to Israel are actually coming from American circles. And if you go through the list of different women's midrashot and women's learning, and I mean, we only have to look at Matan, for example, in Ra'anana to just see that it has a strong American influence. I see Oshra is signed in here. Oshra's, you know, her parents are from America, right? It's just just another example of that many of the leaders Talmidot Chachamim in today's world, and Midrashat Lindenbaum at Nishmat at Matan Migdal Oz are coming from American Orthodoxy. So if I'm not mistaken, I think it was 1975 or 1978. The liberal movement, Reform, decided to start giving women ordination. To start giving women, making women rabbis, okay? And this obviously is still in practice today. And in the conservative movement, it actually created a big debate about what to do. I don't know all the details of the story, but from what I do remember, their biggest Talmid Chacham was a rabbi, a very, very serious Talmid Chacham by the name of Rabbi Shaul Lieberman. Maybe you've heard of him. He was opposed to women receiving ordination. And there was a big discussion between the faculty and the students. And well, Rabbi Lieberman died, okay? And after he died, they waited till after he died, and then they put a vote to the faculty, and this included faculty, you know, people who are not even necessarily Torah scholars, and they voted to allow women to be ordained. And this caused a bit of a firestorm because people felt that this was a very cynical political move. Here you have, you know, they're great scholar saying this, he prohibits it. When he dies, they then, you know, permit it. And, you know, many people left JTS at that time. This is the Jewish Theological Seminary. This was a big deal. This was in the early 80s, I think 1982. Now, at that point, there was an attempt to justify this halachic decision, okay? And the attempt to justify it on the behalf of the conservative movement in America, there's an essay written by a guy by the name of Joel Roth. Okay, he's a conservative rabbi, Joel Roth, a learned guy with no doubt. And he wrote a piece called The Ordination of, what was the piece called exactly? The exact name of the piece was On the Ordination of Women as Rabbis. Okay, I think that's the title. 60-page article, not a short article. Now, and we're going to study his halachic analysis. And then, Rabbi, again, this is my colleague and friend, Rabbi Gideon Rothstein, wrote an article, arguing against this Joel Roth's analysis. Okay, so in order to understand what Joel Roth says, in order to understand Rabbi Rothstein's response, let me just get my charger, one second. Okay, we have to just study a principle called called arivut in halacha. So we know that there's a general idea that if you want to fulfill someone else's obligation for a mitzvah, so Danny, let's say I want to, you know, you need to shake your the lulav and the dalad minim on Sukkot. Can you say, hey, Rabbi, I would like you to, you know, to take the dalad minim and take them and make the bracha and shake them for me? Will that count? Will that fulfill your mitzvah? Yes or no? No. Why not? Why not, Marilyn? Why not, Leslie?
Because there's an obligation for everybody to shake their own lulav.
Good. There's an obligation for everybody to shake their own lulav. Okay. Good. Good. Now,
and I use the word everybody, including women as well.
Okay.
Because they've taken it on themselves.
Okay. Wow. We're jumping right into this. Let's jump right in at first. Okay.
In this case.
Yeah, Marilyn. Yeah.
Basically, only in this case. We're obligated, not always.
Okay. So very interesting points that everyone's raising. Now, I asked Danny specifically because, Danny's a man and he is obligated in the mitzvah. Okay. Women are allowed to perform the mitzvah, but they're not obligated. Okay. So the question is in terms of obligation. Now, what's the reason that I can't perform the mitzvah for Danny? I mean, if we were sitting at a Shabbat table, I could make kiddush and he could listen to the kiddush, say amen, and he fulfills his obligation to make kiddush. What's the difference between lulav and kiddush? I'm just curious. Anybody know?
One is a physical act, and one is with speaking.
Yeah, femo.
In the same way, you can't wash his hands for him to do your diet.
Correct, Leslie. The lulav needs to be performed by a person's body. Okay, it's an act that a person takes a lulav and makes a bracha and then shakes it in different directions. Whereas the kiddush is just about, it's a recitation of words, okay? And so there's a difference here. But what we're getting to is the idea that in halacha, you can perform a mitzvah for somebody else. You can. Not in every instance. I can make kiddush for Danny. And by the way, everybody on this right now, on this Zoom, has an obligation to make kiddush, okay? Women and men, I can make kiddush for any of you and fulfill your obligation. Even if I made Kiddush already, I can make it a second time. Let's say I go from Kiddush Club to Kiddush Club and I'm making Kiddush for everyone. That's also fine. Now, this is all based on a principle called Arevut. Arevut means Kol Yisrael Arevim Zevazeh. All Jews are connected. All Jews are guarantors for each other. And therefore, we can help other people to perform a mitzvah. Let's give another example. Let's say you're eating an apple. Can I make the bracha for you to eat your apple? Why not?
Because you're not eating the apple. You can't make the bracha if you're not eating the apple.
I'm not eating the apple. Nachon. Now, if I were eating the apple, okay, there's an interesting discussion about that, about whether I can make the bracha for you, and in certain circumstances, you can. But that's an act of eating. You have to be eating the apple in order to fulfill that obligation, right, or to make that bracha. Now, let me ask you a question. Danny, we were talking about, you know, let's go back to the lulav case. Let's say I took my I don't have an 8-year-old son. Let's say I had an 8-year-old son. Can he make kiddush for you, Danny? Can he fulfill your obligation? Or Leslie, can my son, 8-year-old son, make kiddush for you? Everyone has an obligation. Why can't he do it? Sylvia, can an 8-year-old kid make kiddush for you on Shabbat?
He's not officially obligated.
He's not officially obligated. Why? Because he's
a minor.
He's only 8 years old. In order to fulfill someone else's obligation, you need to have the same level obligation, right? You have to be equal, okay? So let's say, I'll give you another example. Let's say I have a huge meal, a huge feast, and I have bread, and I need to say Birkat HaMazon, okay? I need to say Birkat HaMazon. And let's say, Don, you also, or Sylvia, okay? Sylvia, or let's use Don for an example. Don, you also have... went away, okay. Let's say, there we go, there's Don. Let's say, Don, you... are you guys sitting in different places, Don and Leslie?
Yes.
I love it, okay.
Social justice.
Separate but equal.
At Matanya, we'd sit together. At home, you sit separately.
Because you're limited to a certain size screen at home.
Yeah, that is true.
Because you froze.
Oh, sorry.
The principle of.
There's a principle called Arevut. Was it that? No, there's a Arevut. Principle. Okay. There's a principle that you have to have the same level obligation. So a minor can't bench for an older person because they don't have, they're by the definition of their age, they can't have the same level obligation. But another example might be if Don only ate, you know, a little crumb of bread, but I ate a full kizayit, a whole meal of bread, he can't bench for me because he's not obligated to do birkat hamazon, right? He doesn't have to make a bracha achrona. So different levels of obligation, you have to have the same level obligation, both in terms of, excuse me, I'm sorry, I apologize, I'm not wearing a mask now. You have to have the same identity as a person and the same level obligation in order to fulfill someone else's mitzvah for them, okay? And this stems from the principle of arevut, okay? Now we get to the what happens with, now let's get to Joel Roth again. Now, Joel Roth felt, what might you think might be some of the obstacles to a woman becoming a rabbi? Whether you agree with her or not, what might be some of those obstacles?
Well, she hasn't got the same obligations.
She doesn't have the same obligations. So that means a woman is not going to be able to fulfill many of the mitzvot. That means she's not going to be able to join a minyan, and she's not going to be able to make kiddush, for example, potentially, for someone else. Or she won't be able to fulfill certain obligations, be part of a tzibur, that a man will be able to be part of, right? Other problems could be, we don't need to get into other issues right now. Maybe we'll get to them in the future. But it's from this angle that Roth wants to address this. Now, Roth wants to make the case that do women have the same obligation as men in halacha? So let's open up our source sheet. Okay, this is last week's source sheet. And it's on the screen now. I'm sharing it on the screen. It's the same text as last week on the bottom part of last week, okay? I just put it into its own document, okay? But this was on the source sheet from last week if you just go to the bottom, okay? So let's see two sources which teach us generally about women's obligations in mitzvot, okay? So number one, Cheresh, this is the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Kaf Tet Amud Aleph. Everyone see this on the top? Everyone with me?
Good. Could you make it slightly bigger on the bottom instead of 100%, 120 or something?
No problem. Be happy.
On the bottom right.
Yeah.
Did we get this source sheet?
No. I don't think so.
We didn't get this source sheet. Yeah.
So this is the same source sheet from last week.
No, we got part one last week.
I know. I just made it into part two, but it's still really hard.
It's page four from last week.
Yeah, we didn't do this part last week.
It's page four.
Page four from last week. Yeah.
I see it. Thank you.
Okay, good. Good. Fantastic. Okay, so we are... what does the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah say here? Cheresh shote v'katan ein motzi'in et rabbi midei chovatan. A shote, a person who's mentally challenged, a katan, a minor, and a cheresh, a person who is deaf, not fulfill the obligation for somebody else. Okay, and there's a principle. Kol she'enu mechuyav badavar enu motzi'a terabim edei chovatan. If you're not obligated, you cannot fulfill someone else's obligation. Can a child read the Megillat Esther for a woman? The answer is no, because he has a lower level obligation than a woman has. Okay, now let's go to the next Gemara in Masechet Kiddushin. In Masechet Kiddushin, we have this idea that kol mitzvah taseh she'azman grama anashim chayavim. When it comes to time-bound mitzvot, men are obligated, v'nashim p'turot, and women are patur. The kol mitzvah to say shelo hazman grama. Any mitzvah to say that is not zman grama, that is not time-bound. Echad anashim v'echad anashim chayavim. women and men are both obligated. And now the third category, the chol mitzvah lo ta'aseh, negative commandments, bein shazman grama, bein shelo zman grama, echad anashim ve'echad anashim chayavim. Let me explain all of this. We have three categories of mitzvot. Let's first start with negative mitzvot. Negative mitzvot, men and women are both obligated in. Women are not allowed to violate Shabbat. Men cannot violate Shabbat. Women cannot engage in idolatry. Men cannot engage in idolatry. Women cannot lie and steal. Men cannot lie and steal. Negative commandments, everything's the same. The difference is with regards to time-bound mitzvot. When it comes to time-bound mitzvot, positive commandments, if something is time-bound, women are not obligated. Men are obligated. And when it comes to non-time-bound mitzvot, both women and men are obligated. Can you give me an example of a time-bound mitzvah? Who could give me an example? Time-bound mitzvah. Anybody?
Tefillin.
Tefillin.
Shofar, shofar, lulav.
Shofar, lulav, tzitzit. These are all time-bound mitzvot, but they have to be performed at a certain point in the day or at a certain point in the week or a certain point in the Jewish calendar. Okay, so men are obligated, women are not obligated. Now, how many mitzvot, by the way, positive commandments are women not obligated in?
How many?
How many are there? Yeah.
Well, three.
Tefillin.
Good question.
How many are there? What are we talking about? Are we talking about 50, 100? I'm going to show you something very, very cool right now. This is one of the beautiful things of Zoom that I could just show you my Bar Ilan. This is Bar Ilan, is the, you know, bunch of Jewish sources here, hundreds of Jewish sources. Going to the Sefer Mitzvot of the Rambam, okay? And in his Sefer HaMitzvot, the Rambam's commandments here, Book of Commandments, he has Sefer HaMitzvot, let's say.
There are also lots of exceptions, obviously, to the rule.
Yes, there are many exceptions to the rule, correct.
But they're patur, they're not asur.
Correct. Very good, Lindsay. Very good, Leslie. Nachon, that there are, here we go, 1 second. I'm just looking for this list. Here we go. Okay, correct. We're going to get there in 1 second. The Rambam says here, that there are four that, 1 second. That there are 14 mitzvot. There are 14 mitzvot that women are not obligated in. That's it. 14. Okay? We're not talking about a huge list here. There are 14 mitzvot. Okay? Tefillin, tzitzit, lulav, shofar, those are four right there. Okay, so sorry, let me go back to this. Let's go back to here to Bar Ilan. Let me go back to the source sheets. Okay, so we're not talking about a major difference here, even though we're, you know, it does play out as we'll see in certain areas. Now let's look at a few, one more basic Gemara, and then we'll get into a really interesting example. We're here on Talmud Bavli, Daf Kaf Amud Bet. This is Brachot, Daf Kaf Amud Bet, right here. I'm just going to highlight it for everybody so everybody can see it. Amar Le Ravina Le Rava. Ravina says to Rava, Nashim Bevirachat HaMazon Doraita or Dorabanan. Do women have a Torah obligation to recite Birkat HaMazon or only a rabbinic obligation? So the Gemara asks, the Mai Nafkamina, well, what's the difference? Why does it matter? And the answer is, Lafuke Rabbi Midei Chovatam, in order to fulfill someone else's obligation. If women have a Torah obligation, ati d'oraita umapi d'oraita. If it's a d'oraita, then women can fulfill man's obligations for Birkat HaMazon by saying Birkat HaMazon. Women can see one for it. If it's only d'rabanan, have she'enu mechuyav badavar. If it's only d'rabanan, then it's like they're not obligated. Then they cannot fulfill the obligation for men. Okay? Does everyone get these general principles? We get the general view here? Okay? It's about having equal obligation. Okay? Good. Now we're going to look at a very controversial source, which also happens to relate to the time period that we are in the Jewish calendar. Now we're looking at the Magen Avraham. Magen Avraham is a commentator by the name of Rabbi Avraham Gumbiner. Okay, and he's a commentator on the Shulchan Aruch. And the question that he's addressing is whether women are obligated in Sfirat HaOmer. Are women obligated in Sfirat HaOmer? Yes or no? What do you think?
Yes.
No.
No.
No. I think yes.
Yes.
Okay, why yes, why no? What's the logic here?
The mitzvah says Shazman Grama.
It's a mitzvah that says Shazman Grama. It's a time-bound mitzvah. Can you get a more quintessential time-bound mitzvah than Sfirat HaOmer, right? So what do we assume?
But it's very loose.
Absolutely. Loose. Nighttime is any time after dark until midnight.
Okay, first of all, you can count Sfirat HaOmer all day, right? If you forgot to count last night, for example, you can count today. However, you still need to count the right day in the right 24-hour period. So it's a time-bound mitzvah in that sense, right? It's also time-bound because it's going to be a particular time in the year. It's, 49 days out of the whole year. Now, what does the Magen Avraham say? He says, Nashim Peturot Nisvirat Omer Dehevi Mitzvah Tasei Shehazman Grama. Women are Petur. It's Mitzvah Tasei Shehazman Grama. He quotes the Rambam here in the Zohar. But now the Magen Avraham is going to say something really fascinating. Umihu, nonetheless, and these are the most important words in the Shiur today. Umihu. However, nonetheless, kvar shavya alayhu chova. Nonetheless, women have taken it upon themselves as an obligation. They see themselves, or they have established for themselves as an obligation. Now, where do we see this idea of a person taking on an obligation that they don't have in other areas of halacha? We have this, for example, by Arvit. Now, there's no Torah obligation to daven Arvit every day, daven Marav. We daven it. We say, we've taken upon, or the Jewish people have taken upon themselves as an obligation. Okay? Now, what might be the consequences of this opinion of the Magen Avraham? Let's think to everything we've already studied today. Like, why is this relevant? How does this connect to what we just learned?
Well, because women are taking on extra mitzvot, like shofar, lulav.
And therefore, what? But so okay.
Well,
so
they can do it for somebody else.
Okay. Shoshana Yafemor. So first of all, we have two questions here. Number one, just for women themselves, if you self-obligate yourself, what happens? Meaning, does self-obligation create a real obligation? Right? An obligation meaning, in terms of the halachic system. So a woman decides to do something and she says, well, I'm going to take on this mitzvah. I'm going to count Sfirat HaOmer. I'm going to listen to the shofar every single year. Does that self-obligation translate into, let's call it a metaphysical halachic obligation? Okay, that's number one. But number two, Shoshana, you get to the fundamental question. Does this mean that women can count Sfirat HaOmer for men? Does this mean that a woman can blow a shofar for a man?
That's what I'm saying.
So this is the fundamental question. If, and again, it's assuming that number one works. If we answer question number one in the affirmative, then we can get to question number two. Do they have the same obligation as men? That they can now do these mitzvot for men. And that would mean also that a woman could, be a shlichat tzibur for men and fulfill an obligation for men in tefillah or kriyat hatorah or whatever it is. This position of the Magen Avraham is going to be the linchpin for Joel Roth's responsa on this issue, okay, for his long essay on this issue. Now, go on.
Two things. First of all, it's talking about women in general or a particular woman decided to...
Okay, it's a really important point. Let's say the women in my Matan Judaism and the Ism Shira decided to take on Sfirat HaOmer. What are the ramifications for other women? Right? What are the ramifications there? Yeah.
Okay, the Magen Avraham is talking about women in general. He doesn't mean one woman, obviously. And the thing about Davening Maariv talks about the whole Jewish people.
Yes. Okay, so that's what we're gonna get to. This is gonna become one of the challenges. Now the Mishnah Berurah, just to fill in the two more halachic sources, the Mishnah Berurah here, he paskins v'nashim v'avadim peturim. These are two other commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, the Mishnah Berurah written by the Chafetz Chaim. V'nashim v'avadim peturod mitzvah zo, the mitzvah zeh shazman grama. So women are patur, as we said first, but then the katav v'magen Avram miu kfar shavi alechova. And then the Mishnah Berurah writes v'chemedume divimedino tenu lo nahage nashei klal. He says, in our countries, this is, he's in Radin. Radin is in, I guess, in, is this in Lithuania, I think, right?
Lithuania, definitely in Lithuania.
Okay. He says, lo nahagina sheklau, this is not the custom. Lispor. So he's saying, maybe it was true in your time, Rav Avram Gumbiner, but not in my time. The katav b'sefer Shulchan Shlomo, dal kopanim lo yivarchu, the Shulchan Shlomo writes, they shouldn't make a bracha. The vada yitu biyom achar, v'gam aponim rovin am yadim peru shamilav. Says, first of all, they're definitely going to make a mistake and they'll forget. And then they'll be making a bracha levatala because they won't fulfill the mitzvah. But then he says also, they don't even know the meaning of the words.
Cheek.
Okay. Absolutely. What was that, Leslie? What was that?
I said chutzpah, cheek.
Chutzpah, okay.
Very tough words.
Okay, yeah. These are, yeah. So we one can read this as a, what he... You know, I want to be charitable here that the Shulchan Shlomo is, possibly describing, the state of women's education at the time. You know, women were illiterate. Women were not going to school. If you don't go to school, we live in totally completely different times. Don't even realize, even men, all the men know how to read today in today's world. That wasn't the case back then, right? So these are, we live in a totally different world just in terms of literacy. This is what they say. So the Mishnah Berurah would say women shouldn't count. Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michal Levi Epstein, and this is the he's in where is he? He's also in Russia, same area. V'anashim b'durod mishum darim mitzvah seish hazman grama. Women are not obligated because it's a time by mitzvah. Mikom akom nagu levarech, but they have the custom to do so. V'linot kechol mitzvah seish hazman grama, and to count like all other mitzvah seish hazman grama. Shanashim noa goat, kishofar v'sukkah v'lulav. He says, and they can do them like all other ones that women generally do, like shofar, sukkah, and lulav. So it's interesting, just first of all, sociologically or historically. Well, who's right? The Aruch HaShulchan seems to suggest women are doing this in his time. Mr. Berurah says, no. They're both living in similar areas in Europe, in Eastern Europe. So it's really interesting to compare them here. But there's one more source. Okay, now I want to get into this. So this is, it's based on this position that that Rabbi Roth, okay, this guy Joel Roth. So let's see, let's read this paragraph down below. Okay, we're going to see a little bit of what he says. Okay, just Roth concedes all this. No egalitarian rabbi, he's not an egalitarian rabbi, although he's conservative. He condemns the conservative decision to count women in general in a minyan. Women do not share women's obligation for public prayer and therefore cannot join them in forming a minyan or leading them in public prayer. But Roth has a novel construct for dealing with this troublesome halachic reality. If women obligate themselves in these mitzvot, he argues, they are the equal of men in obligation and can be motzi them. Thus, those women who obligate themselves in tefillah b'tzibur, and only those women, would count in a minyan and qualify as a cantor. Taking such an obligation would be a requirement for entering the ordination program. So this is Roth's very novel idea here. Why can women can self-obligate themselves, and then they can join a minyan or tefillah b'tzibur and be a chazanit, whatever it is, for men. Now, where does Roth get this from? Well, guess what? He gets it from our Magen Avraham, which we just read about Sfat Omer. Roth tries to develop this concept of being self-obligated on the basis of a statement in the laws of counting the Omer by the Magen Avraham, Rav Avraham ben Chaim Halevi Gumbiner. Okay? So, and then we know what it says now, what the Magen Avraham says.
Okay? Nice question here.
Sure.
If I can understand that a woman may want to obligate herself to do certain mitzvot, and if she does, then she has, once she obligates herself, she has the obligation. Mm-hmm. But does that necessarily mean that self-obligation is the same as an original obligation from the Torah?
$1 million question. That's it. That's exactly, you know, that's going
to
be
one. He's making that assumption here that it's equal to an obligation from Hashem.
Correct. Mm. Correct. And that's exactly where, that's where Rabbi Gideon Rothstein is going to, that's what he's going to say. So I'm stopping sharing for a second. Okay. Now I want to share with you the arguments that Rothstein makes against this argument. Okay. So number one is actually what Chava, you just said. Let's say a woman could obligate herself, and let's say that creates a new halachic reality. Who says they can be motzi, that they could discharge the obligation for a man who has a Torah obligation to do these things, right? It, even if it creates a real obligation, as opposed to just something voluntary, who says you could be motzi somebody else? Point number two is that, you know, even this piece in the Magen Abraham, it's a very late source. This is like a 17th century source. There's no Talmudic idea of there's no Talmudic basis for this. And so, you know, anytime you want to innovate something new, you really have to have strong precedent for it. But furthermore, point number three that Rabbi Gideon Rothstein makes is that other people disagree with this piece in the Magen Avraham. We saw the Mishnah Berurah, for example. Now let's look at the source sheet again. Let's look at the position of the Minchat Chinuch, okay? The Minchat Chinuch. So I'm just going up back to the source sheet a little bit further up. Minchat Chinuch. This is a commentary on the Sefer HaChinuch. And he says here, V'anashim v'avadim p'turim mitzvah zo d'havim mitzvah t'asei shazman grama. V'ayein b'magen Avraham. Look at the Magen Avraham. Katav, he writes, V'ha'idna, in today's times, shavi alai u'chobah. Women have created an obligation for themselves. V'davar zeh tzarich yun. He says, this thing it needs further research. This is new. He says, what? So I've never seen this before, that women can just take on an obligation and then they're suddenly obligated. This is not the same thing as Tefillat Arvit, which we spoke about beforehand. He just says, then look at the Rishonim there. He says, you know, just for example, with Sfirat Omer, there are those who say that the women are prohibited from doing this. The women are prohibited from doing mitzvah seish as man grama, or generally. So how could you say that it becomes an obligation for them? He says, I have no idea where he got this from. So not only do you not have Talmudic precedent for this idea, but you also have interlocutors who disagree with the Magen Avraham. Now, furthermore, point number four that Rabbi Gideon Rothstein makes is that what the Magen Avraham means when he says that women made it an obligation, a chovah, what he probably means from this is that there is, you know, you're making a bracha, you're saying bracha d'Hashem, Asher Asfer to Omer, right? They're obligated to the degree that they don't need to worry about making a bracha that they're not obligated in. Okay, maybe it would be a bracha levatala. He says, no, don't worry, they've taken it upon themselves and it's no longer a bracha levatala. But it doesn't mean it's an obligation in the objective sense. It just means that there's no concern potentially of bracha levatala for that woman to perform the mitzvah. Remember, I don't know if we spoke about this last week, there's a difference here between Sfaradim and Ashkenazim, women, with regards to brachot that one is not obligated in. So let's say a woman shakes a lulav, right? Do you make a bracha, yes or no? What do you think? Yes bracha or no bracha? Woman yes. Says a sukkah, yes bracha or no bracha?
Yes.
Depends where you come from.
No, if we're not obligated, we don't make a bracha.
It's Sfaradim and Ashkenazim. Ashkenazi women make a bracha when they perform a mitzvah that they're not obligated in. Lulav, shofar, sukkah, whatever it is, they make a bracha.
Yeah.
Okay. Whereas,
Rabbi, an interruption here. This is a basic assumption that the whole Torah actually applies to men, that we're just onlookers. The Ten Commandments are give or take. The whole Torah, somewhere this is assuming that every mitzvah in the Torah is directed at men only. And where does that come from?
Okay. Interesting. It's a good question. Actually, Dafka, we're coming up to Ma'amar Har Sinai, and in Parshat Yitro, we're told, Kol Tamar Levet Yaakov V'Tagei Livnei Yisrael. Tell the, the women, Beit Yaakov, that's where the notion of Beit Yaakov comes from, V'Tagei Livnei Yisrael, and tell the Jewish people. One second, I just want to see, someone wrote it on the chat. Okay, fine. It's a fair question. Where does it come from? But this is the assumption that's rough. Again, women are obligated in 600 and it was, there's 613 mitzvot. They're obligated in 599 mitzvot. 599. It's a good number, you know. They're obligated in most of the mitzvot as well, but not obligated in certain positive commandments, which, if you look at them as a category, are things that are some of the, the parts of daily life. You know, it's daily life Judaism, we'll call it, right?
But my question actually is that written in the Torah or is that the Rabbanan?
Okay, so where is the idea that women... Okay, so it's a good question. Where is this notion of mitzvot aseh shehazman grandma that women are not obligated in? So the truth is the Rambam himself in Masechet Kiddushin and his commentary to Kiddushin, his Mishnah commentary, he says, well... The truth is that this is not an absolute principle, because there are positive commandments that women are obligated in. Take eating matzah on Seder night. Do women have to eat matzah on Seder night? Yes. Sure yes. Do women make kiddush on Shabbat? Absolutely. So there are positive commandments. So the Rambam suggests, well, it's more of a mnemonic device. It's more of a general principle, which isn't even true in every case. So the answer to your question is that each mitzvah that women are not obligated in, the Gemara brings an explanation for why women are not obligated in that mitzvah. Okay, there's like a specific derivation or, you know, that tends to be the, how it works. And it's only 14 mitzvot. We're not talking about so many mitzvot here. Now, what else does Rabbi Gidon Rothstein say in response here? So, one second. Let me just get that. So he says, furthermore, that the Magen Avraham might just be describing a historical reality. This is what women in his time have done. He's not saying necessarily that it should create an obligation, and certainly moving forward that includes other mitzvot, that this is the case. Now, based on this logic also, Roth would have to prove that women, are taking on the obligation of tefillah as a chiyuv. There's got to be a mechanism for that. Other arguments that he brings. So basically, Roth's argument is that there's a person can become a mitzuveh, in a sense. They could become obligated in the mitzvot through self-obligation. And this, Gidon Rothstein brings a whole range of arguments against this notion, and it's a pretty compelling argument. Rothstein also points out, you're going to have a conservative movement with half the women being obligated and half them not being obligated, and it's a very confusing reality. So he ends off, Rothstein ends off his own article, saying, well, I'll read to you Rothstein's article. This is an article that appears in Tradition Magazine. This is in the 1988, fall of 1988. He ends off his article. The issue of women in Judaism is a complex one, which deserves continuing attention. There's much room within halacha to accommodate those women who, out of the love of God and Judaism, are seeking to extend their role in the religion to its halachic limits. Okay? And there should be efforts within halachic circles to do so. However, taking a major step such as allowing women to fulfill men's obligation to mitzvot, to which they have no relevance on the basis of a fairly weak halachic argument, can only serve to widen the gap between conservative Judaism and the halachically sensitive community, and make that community less receptive to those changes in the women's role, which are completely acceptable halachically. Okay, so Gidon Rothstein argues that not only does he think that it's not a strong argument, but he also thinks it's counterproductive, that if you push the boundaries on something that's very weak, it's going to, orthodoxy is going to sort of step back and say, well, we're going to be more concerned about making changes here, whatever you want to call it. They're gonna be less willing to make change based on these things. So this is, I've brought this in as a model of a how shall we say, an attempt to demonstrate, well, women and men should have the same obligations in today's day and age. And what would that, in theory, that halachic mechanism look like? Well, it would derive in this case from the Magen Avraham. But we see that this is a very weak argument here, because you're taking one statement by the Magen Avraham, which is no precedent, which is argued against, which is only applied by Sfirat HaOmer, and you're expanding it to all of halacha, and then you're saying that it has the same obligation as men, and therefore women can fulfill obligations for men as well. So this is one attempt and a response to address issues of modernity, feminism, and the halachic process. Okay, and now I want to move to the second model, which is Rav Nachum Rabinovich. Okay, and I want to tell you a little bit about him. I sent this source sheet to you through WhatsApp. Okay, yeah. I'll just wait a second.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I'm probably wrong because I have a tendency to misquote things that I remember. Wasn't there a klal yoter gadol scharo shechayav oseh melo chayav oseh?
Okay, basically kol mitzuveh ve'oseh. Basically, if you're commanded, you have a larger reward. Why? Because the halacha is premised on the notion that something voluntary is good; it's excellent. But if you're commanded to do something, it's harder to do it. Okay, and Judaism is all about command, and therefore the reward is slightly greater for men when they perform mitzvah than for women. But women still get a great reward; it's just slightly lower because it's some of the things are stemming from voluntary choices rather than obligations. Okay,
but it still means that it's better if you're obligated.
Say again.
It still means that it's superior if you're obligated.
Correct.
Or it's better if you're obligated.
It is superior to be obligated. Correct. It is still superior to be obligated. Okay, let me tell you about Rav Nachum Rabinovich. Okay, Rav Nachum Rabinovich, first of all, I'm sharing with you a sefer of his. It's called Mesilot Bilvavam. Okay, actually, I have a few of his sefarim right here. Also, Siach Nachum. We have Darkah Shel Torah. We have Yunim Mishnato Shel Rambam. Okay, these are all books on my shelf here. Rav Rabinovich was a great, great Talmid Chacham Posek Gedol Hador. Okay, unfortunately, he passed away at the age of 92, just a few weeks ago. Let me pull up a picture of him so you can see what he looks like. Novich, okay, and I'll tell you a little bit about him. Okay, can everyone see this? Let me just share the screen here. Share the screen. Okay, and you can see these are pictures of Rav Nachum Rabinovich. Okay, he just passed away at the age of 92. He was born in 1928 in Montreal. Okay, he goes on to studies in Ner Yisrael, learns with Rav Hirschsprung in Montreal. Young, very serious Ilui. He also does a degree in mathematics. And at the age of 31, he was offered to be the chief rabbi of South Africa. Okay? Chief rabbi of South Africa, age 31. He turns this down. Why does he turn it down?
Because of apartheid.
The apartheid. He refused to be chief rabbi of, in a country with apartheid. Okay? Rav Nachum Rabinovich then goes on to become, he's a rabbi in Charleston, South Carolina. Then he becomes a rabbi in Toronto. There in Toronto, he finishes his PhD in statistics and mathematics, okay, on Talmudic mathematics, and he becomes a lecturer in university. He then goes on to Jews College, where he becomes the head of Jews College. He becomes Rabbi Jonathan Sachs's rabbi in Jews College. And at that point, he starts writing a commentary on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. This commentary on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah ends up being 21 volumes long. 21 volumes. Okay, I'll just get you one from the shelf here, because I don't have it all to myself. Okay, it's called Yad Pshuta. Okay, this volume itself is, 850 pages. Okay, so he writes 21 volumes on the Rambam, okay? Along with his other Sfarim as well, okay? So he's a voluminous writer. Now, he, in his essays on Jewish thought, which are Mesilot Bilvavam, and he's also very fascinating because he tends to have right-wing views around issues of, political issues, Israel and the Palestinians and the Arabs, but very left-wing views when it comes to issues of religion and state. Kfiyat Datit, he does not like Kfiyat Datit. And he posits, he has an article here about the status of women in halacha, okay? And this article is called Ma'amad Aisha Ben Chazon B'Metziut, the status of women in halacha between the ideal and the real, between the real and the ideal, okay? And I've shared with you in this document his essay. Okay, so I'm going to share this on the screen. I'm going to share it on the screen, but you also can, you know, look at it on your screen as well. Just going to make it a little bit smaller each page. Okay, can everybody see this?
Yeah.
Okay, good. What I want to do is take you through this article and share with you his view on this issue, and we'll see how it dovetails with Rabbi Gideon Rothstein's piece. So he starts with Yichuda shel Aisha, okay? The unique status of women, okay? Em Kochai, the mother of all. Who's called Em Kochai? Who is that?
Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Mother of life, Sarah.
No,
Chava.
Eve is Em Kochai, okay?
Muted, Chava, yeah.
Yeah, Chava, it's good you answer that, and you better know that. Good. Okay. HaTorah Mitziga B'Parashat Breshit. The Torah presents in Sefer Breshit an ideal relationship between husband and wife, and an ideal status of women in the world, and we'll call it a realistic description, okay? And these two things exist, they coexist side by side, okay? Let's go to the second paragraph. Kfar ba'eit ha-briyah, already at the point of creation, Hutzga ha-merechet ha-ruya kematara elyona kema'amar ha-katuv, zachar nekeva ber'am ba'ikra shemam adam v'yom hibar'am. Already, right at the beginning of creation, God sets out the ideal. What is the ideal? Men and women are created equal, same time, same status, okay? That is the original status. Okay, that's the ideal, we'll call it the ideal. I shouldn't say the original, that's the ideal, okay? Mito'eret kan shutafut mele'ah mibein ha'ish ba'isha. What is described in Sefer Breshit is an absolute partnership, an equal partnership. Shutafut ba'erkam shel shnei shutafim shaven, which they are both equal. Shneim biyachad me'avim adam ideali. Both of them are, you know, part of the ideal man or human. Ve'ein shlemut la'acher im dafka la'achad imkin dafka hasheni. They complement each other. Shneim biyachad amrim la'olid dor de'a le'godlo. And they're both given the obligation to, you know, to raise families, etc. Okay. However, he thinks that each man and women have like slightly different tafkidim. Okay. See, and how is this breakdown? Okay. He says, each of them have slightly different, you know, roles. Okay. In terms of bringing, creating the world and furthering the world and bring peace to the world. Okay. Okay, now what is a woman's role according to this? He says, Adam HaRishon recognized Chava's ideal role. And what is that? Chava. Ki hi haita im kol chai. This is to be a mother, to be a nurturer. The ituya yichudi shel akriya b'sipur maaseh b'rashid yesh mashmaut rabba. This, the point in which Adam calls her Chava is very critical, because it's after the chait of the eating of the fruit. Okay, and what are we told right there? He's going to have a really brilliant interpretation of this whole incident. He says, "Hein Adam haya ke'achad mimenu ladat tov v'ra." Man, God is afraid, kibyachol, that man, if he eats the Eitz Hadat and the Eitz HaChaim, he will be like God, to know good and evil. Now, we know a man came to know evil. Okay, how did he come to know evil? Because he ends up eating from the Eitz Hadat. Okay, and then he blames God for this, and he says, God, you, this woman that you gave me, she's responsible for me sinning, and that's how man comes to know evil, through the eating of the Eitz Hadat. Okay. Okay, this page did not photocopy as well as I would have liked it to. Second, let me just open up the book though. Okay, but then Rav Rabinovich asks the following question. When do we see that man also learns about goodness after he eats from the Eitz Hadat? We know that he learns sort of to be bad, to blame Chava for this, and you know, etc. Where does he learn to be good? Okay, so Rav Rabinovich explains as follows. This is really a powerful interpretation. When he hears that he's been punished, that the ground will be punished because of him, that on shah hamar shel ishto lo itvakeach, lo itmamer al kilato, v'lo anak klum. Tegubato ligzera ve'alafar tashub aita, v'ikra adam shem ishto chaba ki aita im kochat. It's after that man and woman are punished that Adam turns to Chava and says, Chava, you are Ein Kol Chai. Now, what is the meaning of this, of him naming her this at this point in time? So what do we learn from this? He says as follows. This is a moment of regret. This is a moment where Adam recognizes how he mistreated her. Therefore, we turn to her in concern and love. After she's been cursed, and he's been cursed, he's been told it's going to be painful to have children, and if they're going to die, he says, don't worry, you're going to be a nurturer, a mother. This is a way of comforting her. This is a way of recognizing that it was wrong that he blamed her. Okay? This is not a negative description or negative, a name that he's giving her. This is the ideal role that a woman plays. It's an ideal role as a nurturer, as a giver, as one who raises children and a family. Okay, so this moment that Adam recognizes that his wife is not just the cause of his sin, she is also as tremendous potential to give to the world and to give to other people. So in the end, we see that Adam, not only does he learn from this, you know, he sins and becomes, you know, does something bad, he also learns to be good. He learns how to redeem himself in this particular instance. Okay? Now, this is what Rav Rabinovich terms the ideal relationship between man and woman, okay? There's shutafut, there's partnership, there's respect, there's mutual respect, there's a recognition of each of their roles, okay, which he sees as being positive, okay, and each of their unique qualities, okay? But at the same time, we also see that, you know, you can have a negative relationship here, and that is another statement, another part of their curse, that there's going to be this competition, there's going to be this clashing, there's going to be this dissonance between them, okay, between them. So we're seeing two models. We're seeing the ideal model in the beginning here, but also a less ideal model that might, you know, unfortunately capture reality. Okay, and the goal is for each of them to rise above sin and to merit to each of them to fulfill their potential as individuals, but also as ushneim aleinu tafkidam kish bishutafut, that they could also, you know, succeed together as a partnership, as a joint couple. Okay, he then brings a story of Chana. Chana basically, you know, says to Hashem, Hashem, you know, we may have studied this Gemara in the past, where she says, God, you've created, you know, when she's arguing with God and she's saying, God, you've created me, you know, you've given me eyes to see and ears to hear and a nose to smell and a mouth to eat. but you know, you've given me also breasts. What are these for? I don't have any children, Chana says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so this is here, and you know, this is the argument she makes to Hashem, give me a child. But this is also, again, Rav Rabinovich brings us to prove, he says, there's an important point here. That somehow our tafkidim in the world are connected to our physical makeup, okay? Women who have the ability to feed, to give birth, okay? They're more going to be more connected to birth and to life and to nurturing and to et cetera, and raising a home, then you know, men, it's going to be a little bit different. Okay, so this is the how he looks at it here. Now, here's the key point, and this is like the linchpin of his argument. He says the Torah creates both an ideal and a real. What does the Torah want us to do? The Torah wants us to fulfill the ideal, that there's absolute shutafut between men and women, that there's mutual respect, that they work together both as individuals and as a couple to build a family and to further the world. However, the Torah also recognizes that not everyone's ready for this. And certainly, and historically, they weren't ready for this. They weren't ready for this type of relationship. And men and women, we have to go through a process of growth, of progress in the world, okay, in order for men and women to really be able to actualize this type of relationship. And the Torah sets down both the real and the ideal. Why? Because it recognizes that human beings we're just human, and it takes time for things, for society to change, to evolve over time. But this is a process which Rav Rabinovich believes that the Torah values and recognizes and supports. The Torah wants us to return to this more ideal relationship of shutafut, of equality and true partnership, okay? And he says this is what, you know, this is the journey of history, to get to that ideal and away from the, we'll call it the realistic, the reality on the ground. And he goes through a number of areas in halacha where we've seen that women's status has indeed changed, okay? And he sees this for positive, okay? Let me give you some examples. Let's just take the example of zugiyut, okay, marriage and relationships. In the Torah, you have polygamy. In the Torah, you have and a woman, there's no such thing as a ketubah, okay? Whereas over time, let me just get the page here, okay? Oh, let's take divorce. Let's start with divorce. You could ask, why is the Torah even have divorce in the Torah? Why is an institution in the Torah gerushin? And the answer is, again, ideally a couple should be happy together and build a family together. But there's an understanding that sometimes it doesn't work and you need a way out. And that's why you have divorce, okay? But what about polygamy? The Torah starts with permitting polygamy. Yaakov Avinu has four wives. David HaMelech, Shlomo HaMelech. However, even though polygamy is permitted, we know the Torah also recognizes that it's not the ideal. When does the ideal become fulfilled in a sense? This is the Takanav Rabbeinu Gershom. This is 10th century, when polygamy becomes prohibited, at least in the Ashkenazi world. Sfaradim are still doing this for some time. And this is an example where the Torah not only wants, but projects that this is the arc of history. This is where history is going to move to. And this is a positive, thing. Other example, Kiddushei Ketana, in the time of the Gemara, you can marry off your daughter when she's a young girl. But ultimately, even in the Gemara, time of Rav, it's prohibited because this is a reality, but it's not a ideal, okay? Other examples, come up. He brings examples of an edut in the world of testimony, that there are cases where women are permitted to testify. He sees this sort of becoming more realistic over time and more of a possibility over time. And he goes through that. The areas of Yerushah, inheritance. In the Torah, women do not receive an inheritance. However, halachically, they have over time, okay? Women playing, roles in society. For the most part, their position is their second status, or they're not playing leadership roles as much in Tanakh. But over time, this is developed halachically that women will. And the Rabbi Rabinovich sees this more as the ideal evolves over time, so we get to a place where these things are acceptable in society. Okay, where's the Rabbi Rabinovich get this whole notion from? Some of it comes from the Rambam. where the Rambam says very famously in Moreh Nevuchim, Lamed, third Chelek Gimel Lamed Bet, he says, well, the institution of Korbanot. God created Korbanot for a certain period, but over time they will become obsolete and we get to higher forms of worship. Okay? And this is, it's both in the Torah itself, Tefillah is in the Torah, but it will take time till we move away from a sacrificial order. So this is the argument of Rabinovich. And now we get to the end of the article. Okay? And I'm going to go back to the source sheet and share this document. Okay, and again, same document. But let's get to the end here, where let's see what he does with this. Okay, shivyon umitsui atzmi. Okay, so you know he says in every healthy society, you have to have men and women have to have partnership, and they each need to be able to fulfill their their goals and their objectives in life. And so there's equality of sorts, but he doesn't think it should lead to, thinking that men and women have the same roles in life. He says some people think there has to be absolute, I don't know if equality is the right definition of here, but shivyon is that they're equivalent.
Egalitarian.
Yeah, egalitarian, correct. He says we cannot deny the differences. That appear and physical differences, emotional, psychological. That the existence of man is based on understanding this difference of human beings. He thinks if we run away from these differences, we will be creating destruction in our wake. Okay, and he says in modern times of the full egalitarianism, he thinks is an absurd idea, and it's taking individualism to the extreme. The example he gives actually with regards to breastfeeding, he said that when mothering was looked down upon, and they said women shouldn't have to breastfeed; they could just use formula. In the 60s and 70s, this was like. This was the norm, but today people have come back and say, wait a second, there's nothing like a mother's milk. It's actually by far the healthiest thing for a child, and it builds a connection between the woman and the child, and it gets rid of allergies that have become very dangerous. He says, on the other extreme, they're extremists who look very suspiciously and anyone who emphasizes the im kochai part of a woman, okay, the mother of all of Chava, but that does avrim shal hayachid yod merukaz beatzmon biovad hachavra veatida einam chashuvim umela gam olad giladim chinuchim einam isukim anatnim sipu. He says, well, these people are focused. They don't see value in building a family. They don't see value in community. It's all about what the individual. What does the individual want? Ulan benigud deot edu adraba. Okay. On the other hand, on the other side, if we try to linot kipuach haisha, kipuach, one second, to be honest, I don't even know what this word means. Is kipuach, let's look this up on, anyone know what kipuach means? Kipuach, deprivation, okay? So look at that. He says, if we try to, to stop depriving women, yesh lidog, we have to be concerned, sheha marachot achavratiot, social institutions, yitchashvu b'shoni shebein v'rayim v'nashim, will consider the difference between men and women, v'chapsu drachim afsher l'isha lagia l'shilub nachon yoter, shel hagshamat b'chol kochat ha'ashonim. He says, if we recognize the differences, then we can enable women to both self-actualize, to fulfill their potential, their individual and communal potential, but also maintain their status as being an im kochai. He's saying, Rabbi Rabinovich doesn't want to, one to substitute the other. He says, let us find a way that women can have, play a larger role in society and feel more self-actualized and fulfilled, but not give up, chas v'shalom, their role as mothers, as nurturers. Okay, and then he gets into a little bit about the army, and he thinks it very much bothers him that women go into combat units. He thinks it's the exact opposite of being aim kol chai. This really bothers him, and that's something that he feels very strongly against. And uses very strong language here. So, says if you want to focus just on egalitarianism, it's going to break down the family. A woman whose merits to build a family, to raise them, to build a strong family with good values and grandchildren, great grandchildren, she has tremendous influence on future generations that she should be very proud of. So, let's just this final paragraph here. Because the world has developed and progressed, we live in a world of prosperity. We have an opportunity to help people self-actualize, use their talents, go out to the world. But we have to find the right balance. Everyone has their own choice. But you also need to think about what is the long-term, what are the values to society? What is our long-term goals in terms of building society and creating a healthy society based on families and communities, etc. Now, let's take 3 more minutes to put these 2 pieces into conversation. Let's put Rav Rabinovich and Rabbi Gideon Rothstein into conversation for a second. Let's leave this. This is what we're going to do. We're going to leave this for next time. I want you to think about this. These 2 different pieces we've gotten for a while today. How do these 2 pieces work together? And we're going to bring in other sources and other ideas for next time as well. So I think we have class after Shavuot, correct? On Monday after Shavuot, we have class. Good. Same time, same place. Yishar Koach. And I apologize that we went a little bit long today. We'll make sure to stop at the right time next time. Koach, everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you,
Rabbi.
Chag Sameach. Okay, Chag Sameach. Bye.
Chag Sameach.
You always have class.
Say again, Karen.
Don't worry about